Okay, brethren, we've started last week in reviewing the book of Daniel, which I said at the time hopefully would be a fairly brief summary. We've been through it before, you know, chapter by chapter, verse by verse, takes quite a while. This time I've been asked to go through it much more quickly and perhaps even do a chart at the end of it. So last week we did ask the question, well, why the book of Daniel in any event? And a couple of reasons are that Jesus did warn us to watch out for the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet. And Matthew, the evangelist, added these words, "Let him who reads understand." So it does seem very clearly that the abomination of desolation, which is highlighted several times in the book of Daniel, is key critical. It introduces the great tribulation, and you and I want to be, I'm sure, alert for that. So the book of Daniel, particularly relevant for the end times, which we may see further today. So quick recap of last week. Chapter 1, we saw the captivity of many of the Jews as they were brought to Babylon by King Nebuchadnezzar. Among those Jewish captives was Daniel himself as a very young man, plus his three friends who were renamed as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Even early on in chapter 1, they stood up for their principles regarding what they should eat and so on, which was quite brave of some young guys in a very hostile environment where the king was well known for chopping heads off. That was chapter 1. Chapter 2, we looked at Nebuchadnezzar and his dream of a great statue made of gold and silver and bronze and iron. And Nebuchadnezzar wanted to know what the dream meant. Daniel came along in due course, explained that the four metals of the statue pictured four kingdoms, which would run all the way down to the stone, which was cut out without hands and grew up and filled the earth, which was God's kingdom being established. Okay, and we said last week that chapters 2 to 7, interestingly, are written in the Aramaic language. So chapter 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 and 7, only those six chapters are written in the Aramaic language. Everything else, pretty much in the Old Testament, is Hebrew. And there's reasons why it was written in Aramaic. I think the main reason is that that was the language of, if you like, the world, the Middle East world of those days. Everybody spoke Aramaic. And the content of Daniel 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 appears to have been designed to reach pretty much the whole world of that day. Now, although God had started to deal with Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 2 and the dream of the great statue, Nebuchadnezzar was still a fairly arrogant person. He was, by the sound of it, an absolutely brilliant king. He was the head of gold, after all. And so part of his ideas was to erect a giant image and require that everybody in the entire world that he reigned over to bow down and worship the image. Of course, Daniel's three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, refused, and they were tossed into a burning, fiery furnace to be destroyed. But of course, they were delivered, and a fourth person turned up walking around the fiery furnace with them. Now, Nebuchadnezzar was absolutely astounded. And you'll recollect, he issued a decree to the whole world in Aramaic that the whole world must respect the God of Daniel's three friends. Now, if King Nebuchadnezzar issues a decree in Aramaic to the whole world, you can bet your boots you better pay attention to it. So God's getting his name and reputation out via some really incredible ways to the whole world of that day. Yet, of course, Nebuchadnezzar remains pretty much as arrogant as ever. So God, if you like, escalates has involvement in chapter 4 of Daniel, where Nebuchadnezzar has another dream. This time it's a great tree which is cut down with just the stump left in the ground. Daniel is called in. Daniel explains, oh dear, Nebuchadnezzar, the tree pictures you. And so we find out that Nebuchadnezzar is driven out from mankind for 7 years to live as a beast in the wilderness. Finally, he comes to his senses, acknowledges the God of heaven, praises the God of heaven, and he now writes his personal testimony to the whole world in Aramaic. Chapter 4 of Daniel is Nebuchadnezzar's personal testimony. He says, I, Nebuchadnezzar. And he writes to the whole world that they should honor and praise the God of heaven. The whole Gentile world now knows about the God of heaven via the great King Nebuchadnezzar. Then we came to chapter 5, where we ended last week, where we have another king. This time it's King Belshazzar. He's the last king of Babylon, and he refuses to learn the lessons of his father. He sees this strange image of a hand, disembodied hand, writing on the wall. Daniel is eventually called in and explains, oops, Belshazzar, you refused to learn the lesson of your father. You have been weighed in the balance and found wanting. You will die tonight, and the Babylonian Empire will fall tonight. And that happened. Babylon fell that very evening to the Medes and the Persians. And that's as far as we got last week. But just before we move on to the next chapter, it's worth just bringing out, I think, that there is a curious literary structure that applies across these six Aramaic chapters. As we'll see in a few minutes, chapter 2 and chapter 7 are a pair. They correlate, they echo each other. Then strangely, as we'll see again, chapter 3 and chapter 6 are a pair, and they correlate and echo. And then chapters 4 and 5, which we've just read, or read last week, they also are a pair and correlate and echo. For example, chapter 2, statue with four metals, picturing four kingdoms running down to the kingdom of God. Chapter 7, four beasts representing four kingdoms that take us to the kingdom of God. Chapter 3 and 6 are a pair, yep. Chapter 3 shows us the saints being thrown into a fiery pit and delivered. Chapter 6, we'll see in a moment, is Daniel the saint thrown into the lion's pit and delivered. Chapters 4 and 5 are a pair. Yes, they are. Chapter 4, a great king who repents and acknowledges God. Chapter 5, a king who rejects God and loses everything. So these pairs are in some ways quite helpful, because they echo and often amplify what appears in the pairing chapter. Okay, we're now ready for chapter 6. So if you open your Bible at chapter 6, chapter 6 brings us to the pair of chapter 3, which is Daniel in the lion's den. Now, in Daniel's day at this point, there are lots of important people who are very jealous of Daniel. So they lay a trap for him. They get King Darius to pass a law that says that nobody can approach any other god for 30 days other than approaching King Darius himself. And if they do, they will be thrown into the pit of lions. Now, no surprise, but Daniel, of course, is faithful. We saw that even as a young man in chapter 1. And, of course, Daniel gets caught praying to God despite the king's law. So let's pick up in Daniel 6 and read verses 10 through 17. Now, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home, and in his upper room with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees 3 times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplications before his God. I guess they had some sort of CCTV, you know, stealth in his bedroom and saw what he was up to. And they went before the king and spoke concerning the king's decree. Have you not signed a decree, O king, that every man who petitions any god or man within 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? The king answered and said, well, that's true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. So the answered and said before the king that Daniel, who is one of the captives from Judah, does not show due regard for you, O king, or for the decree that you have signed, but makes his petition 3 times a day. And the king, when he heard these words, was greatly displeased. Well, was he? Yeah, greatly displeased with himself, because he saw the trap immediately, because he had the highest respect for Daniel. So verse 14, the king, when he heard these words, was greatly displeased with himself and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. And he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. Was there some loophole, some sort of caveat? Is there something he can find somewhere in the law that can allow him to spring Daniel from the trap? Verse 15, then these men approached the king and said to the king, know, O king, that it is the law of the Medes and Persians, so to which you are subject, basically, that no decree or statute which the king establishes may be changed. That is the imperial law. So, what can he do? The king gave the command, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions, or pit of lions. But the king spoke, saying to Daniel, your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you, I hope. Then a stone was brought and laid in the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signets of his lords, that the purpose concerning Daniel might not be changed. And then he lay awake all night. Verse 19, the king arose very early in the morning, probably when it was still dark, and went in haste to the den of lions. And when he came to the den, he cried out with a lamenting voice to Daniel. It sounded like he was a bit pessimistic. The king spoke, saying to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? And then he pauses. Then Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths so that they have not hurt me, because I was found innocent before him. And also, O king, I have done no wrong before you. And then the king was exceedingly glad for him and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatever was found on him, because he believed in his God. And the king gave the command, and they brought those men who had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, and their wives, and the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces before they ever came to the bottom of the den. I suppose that's justice. I mean, there's a proverb that says, he who diggeth a pit shall fall therein, and I guess they didn't have fall therein in this particular case. You can see the pairing with Daniel 3, the three saints who refused to worship Nebuchadnezzar's image, and the king had them thrown into a fiery pit from which they were delivered, thus astonishing the king. And here you've got a saint of God thrown into the pit of lions from which he is delivered, thus astonishing the king. So, you know, parallels there, pairing there. And of course, what this leads to is verses 25 through 27. Then King Darius wrote, of course, in Aramaic, which the whole world of Scripture understood, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. Just like Nebuchadnezzar did, right? I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and steadfast forever. His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed. His dominion shall endure to the end. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So now it's Darius's turn to issue a testimony to the whole world in Aramaic. You know, make sure you respect and honor the God of Daniel. So what, you know, Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon did with his testimony, now Darius of Medo-Persia does with his testimony. So, you know, one way and another, you know, God in heaven is getting his name and his power and his glory out to the entire Gentile world. That really, I guess, is quite unusual. And so our summary of, I guess, chapter 6 would be God's power revealed to the whole world as he delivers faithful Daniel from the pit of lions. God's power revealed to the whole world as he delivers faithful Daniel from the pit of lions. Okay, and that brings us to Daniel chapter 7, which is the final chapter of what you might call Aramaic Daniel. You know, chapter 1's Hebrew, chapters 8 to 12 are Hebrew, 2 through 7 are all Aramaic. And in chapter 7, as we'll see in a moment, you have four beasts representing four kingdoms and showing us the return of the Lord Jesus and the kingdom of God being established, which, if you think about it, is an echo of Daniel 2, but they're not the same. Daniel 4 and 5 are echoes, but not the same. Daniel 3 and 6 are echoes, but not the same. Daniel 2 and 7 are echoes, but not the same, because Daniel 2, with the great statue of four metals, starts with Nebuchadnezzar and runs all the way down through something like 2,600 years until God's kingdom is established. That's Daniel 2. Daniel 7, I believe, is entirely end time. So there's echoes, but Daniel 7 is all about the end time. Let's look at Daniel 7, verses 1 and then 17 to 18. Daniel 7 and 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, this is the guy who was drinking out of the vessels from the temple, uh-oh, saw the handwriting on the wall. Sorry, mate, you're weighing the balance, your time's up.
You vanish.
Don't pass go, don't collect $200, go straight to jail. This is that Belshazzar. Now, Belshazzar, depending which history book you read, only reigned for about 2 years, maybe 3 years. Right? Very short. And he was the final king of Babylon. Remember, Daniel said, your time's up. And then it says, that very night he was slain, and that very night Babylon fell. So Belshazzar, the last king of Babylon, right almost as the sun was setting, the last couple of years max. So, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream this time, and visions of his head while on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts. Look at verses 17 and 18. Now remember, this is in the last, possibly the last year, 18 months of the Babylonian Empire. But verses 17 and 18 tell us that the four beasts that we'll read about in a moment, this is an angel explaining to Daniel, those great beasts which are four are four kings, and it should say, which shall arise out of the earth, but the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. So you can see two things there. One is, it's right at the end time because the saints of God take over the kingdoms, right? verse 18, the saints of the Most High take charge. The verse before it says, the great beasts, which we'll read about, are four, and our four kings, now my New King James Version says, our four kings, which arise out of the earth. It's a bit ambiguous. What, have arisen? Or are there now, or arise in the future? Well, it means to arise in the future from where Daniel is. You can see that in many, many other translations. For example, I've got three others here. The New American Standard Bible, verse 4 says, these are four kings who will arise. The Amplified says, four kings who shall arise. NIV, four kings that will arise. So think about it. If these four beasts are four kingdoms that will arise, it can't include ancient Babylon because that was down to his last 12 months. You can't say it's going to arise. It's actually just about, you know, disappearing from view. So those are two reasons why I'm pretty sure Daniel 7 is entirely end time. Okay, let's read verses 7, chapter 7, verses 3 through 8. And let's look at these four beasts, which are four kingdoms which will arise. Verse 3. The four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. A very unusual lion. And suddenly another beast, a second, like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And they said thus to it, arise, devour much flesh. Meaning gorge yourself. This would be a particularly destructive beast. After this I looked, and there was another, like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. Picturing probably speed. The beast also had four heads. Okay, the leopard has four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and had 10 horns. So a terrifying beast, and there's nothing quite like it that Daniel can see. He's talked of a lion, bear, leopard, but this is just horrible. I was considering the horns, these 10 horns, and there was another horn, a little one coming up among them, before whom three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots, and there in this horn, strange horn, were eyes, like the eyes of a man, and a mouth, speaking pompous words. Strange symbols these are. Then verses 11 and 12, I watched then because of the sound of the pompous words which this particular horn was speaking. I watched till the beast was slain, and its body destroyed, and given to the burning flame. As for the rest of the beasts, the lion, the bear, the leopard, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. So here we have four beasts comprising seven heads, because one of them had four heads, if you remember, and 10 horns. Now, although the timing is different from Daniel 2, like I said, there are correlations, there are echoes. There were four metals, and the fourth metal was iron. There are four beasts here, has huge iron teeth. So there are these similarities, but the timing is perhaps the main distinction. Daniel 2 is history leading up to Christ's return. Daniel 7 is all end time. But the identification of the beasts is the same. The lion equals Babylon, as it did in Daniel 2. The lion equals Babylon, which today we call modern Iraq. right? So the lion equals modern-day Iraq, which you'll realize, I suspect, is a Muslim country. The bear is Medo-Persia, just as the silver part of the statue was. And Medo-Persia today we call Iran, modern Iran. When I was growing up, it was still called Persia. Now it's called Iran, the Shah Persia. I remember him visiting Britain a few times before he was thrown over by the Ayatollahs. But Persia, we call Iran today. And of course, you'll realize Iran is a Muslim country. The leopard, corresponding to the bronze part of the statue, the leopard with the four heads, is Greece, but not just the little country of Greece that you and I might think of, if you go on holiday, for example. It's more the area of Javan, J-A-V-A-N, which to us today is typically known as Asia Minor. It's a region. If you look at any old Bible map for Javan, you'll tend to see the region shown there. But it has four heads. And I'm going to suggest the four heads are Turkey, Egypt, Syria, and probably Albania. Turkey, Egypt, Syria, and Albania. So it's a coalition of countries, which, by the way, are all Muslim. Right? And then you have the fourth beast, corresponding to the iron legs. The fourth beast corresponds to the iron legs, which is its Islamic empire in the end times. The Islamic empire in the end times, not here yet, but it's coming, which of course, obviously, is Muslim. That's what it means when it says the Islamic empire. And these four beasts run up to the return of Jesus Christ and God's kingdom, because look at verses 13 and 14. So we get verses 11 and 12 about the beast being destroyed, but the other three beasts continue for a while. Verse 13 and 14, I was watching the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man, Jesus, coming with the clouds of heaven, and he came to the Ancient of Days, the Father, and they brought him near before him. Then to him, the Son of Man, Jesus, was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. Right at the end times, right? That's at the end of the end times, pretty much. That's Jesus' return. That's God's kingdom being established. So Daniel's seen all these beasts. The one that really intrigues him is the dreadful, terrible, destructive fourth beast. So he asks specifically about, what's that all about? So let's read the angel's answer in verses 19 through 27. Then I wished to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron, its nails of bronze, which devoured, broke in pieces, and trampled the residue with its feet. And I wanted to know about the 10 horns that were on its head, and about this other special horn which came up, before which three fell, namely, that horn which had eyes, and a mouth which spoke pompous words, arrogant words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. I was watching, and the same horn, this arrogant, pompous horn, which I'm going to suggest is what's typically known as the Antichrist. Not sure I like that term, but I think most people understand who you're talking about. I was watching, and the same horn, this Antichrist individual, was making war against the saints and prevailing against them until the Ancient of Days came. Oops. Are you a saint? Looks like in the end times that this horrific, terrible Islamic empire will make war against the saints and, it says, prevail against them until Jesus returns. Until the Ancient of Days came and a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. So it's right up to Jesus' return and God's kingdom. This is the few years before that, probably the 3 or 4 or 5 years before that. Thus he said, "The fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms and shall devour the whole earth, trample it, and break it in pieces." Now, that phrase, break in pieces, we looked at last week. It's the Aramaic dekak, D-E-Q-A-Q, which, remember, means to smash, to smithereens, to pulverize, as it says, to break in pieces. And there's no way that the Roman Empire ever did that to Greece, to Babylon, or to Persia. But we've covered that before, so I'm not covering it again. Verse 24, "The 10 horns, or 10 kings, who shall arise from this kingdom, another shall arise after them. He shall be different from the first ones and shall subdue," you know, 3 of these kingdoms. "He shall speak pompous words against the Most High," since he's going to be almost certainly an Islamic Antichrist. No surprise there. 1.7 billion people speak against the Most High God because their God is Allah and their prophet is Muhammad. In fact, if you think about it, in 1 John 2 it says, "He is Antichrist who denieth the Father and the Son," right? Well, all Muslims deny the Father and the Son. As far as they're concerned, Allah has no children. Allah is not a father. So 1.7 billion Muslims and this end-time Islamic Antichrist, of course, they're going to deny the Father and the Son. So anyway, verse 25, "He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High," heaven help you if you're a Christian in their country, in their empire, "and shall intend to change times and law." And like I've said before, Sharia law is the law that the Islamic peoples want to establish everywhere where they are a majority. If they're a minority, they tend to keep themselves to themselves. But once they become a majority, Sharia law must come into being. Carrying on in verse 25, "Then the saints shall be given into his hand for time and times and half a time." So the saints are going to be harassed for 3.5 years, which is probably what time, times, and half a time implies. But, verse 27, 26, "The court shall be seated. They shall take away his dominion to consume it and destroy it forever. His days are numbered." And then, after this pompous horn has harassed the saints and sought to change the law for 3.5 years, after that it says, "The kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him." So there we are. We're right up to the return of Jesus and God's kingdom in the days of these four beasts, and in particular, in the days of the powerful fourth beast with the 10 horns. So I guess I would summarize chapter 7 by saying, four beasts representing end-time Islamic nations at war, including war against the saints. Four beasts representing end-time Islamic nations: Iraq, Iran, Asia Minor, and the Islamic Empire. And then we move on to Daniel chapter 8. And with Daniel chapter 8, we're back into the Hebrew language. Not that, of course, you and I notice it's all English to us, or Spanish, whatever your language is, but underlying it, we're back into Hebrew. So the 6 Aramaic chapters, it does seem to be that information was to be broadcast among the Gentile peoples of those days. So in Daniel 8, it's Hebrew, and now Daniel has a vision of a ram and a he-goat fighting each other. And crucially, this vision is definitely for the end time, just as Daniel 7 was for the end time. look at Daniel 8, 15 through 19, verses 15 through 19, and then verse 26, verse 15. Now it happened when I, Daniel, had seen the vision of the ram and he-goat, and was seeking the meaning, that suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, who called and said, Gabriel, angel Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So he, Gabriel, came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid, and fell on my face. But he said to me, understand, son of man, that the vision refers to the time of the end. The end time. Now, as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground. But he touched me and stood me upright, and he said, look, I am making known to you what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation, for at the appointed time the end shall be. And then verse 26, he continues, the angel, the vision of the evenings and mornings which was told is true, therefore seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. Now verse 19 is a little bit awkward in the New King James Version, but if you take the NIV as an alternative, verse 19 reads, the vision concerns the appointed time of the end. So verse 17 says the time of the end. Verse 19 says the appointed time of the end. And verse 26 in the NIV says, seal up the vision, for it concerns the distant future. And so, assuming that you and I are actually now in the end time, this vision concerns us, right? Because it's an end time vision. Okay, look at Daniel 8. Let's read verses 3 and 4. Then I lifted my eyes and saw, and there, standing beside the river, was a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, southward, so that no beast could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. So here's this ram charging to the north and the south and the west. Who is the ram? Well, look at verse 20. The ram which you saw, having the two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia, which is modern-day Iran. So in the end time, in the far distant future, this is the nation of Iran. And it charges west, it says, north and south. Well, west of Iran, if you look on a map, is Iraq and Syria, and also, if they want to try it, Israel. To the north of Iran, you find eastern Turkey, eastern Asia Minor, and some of the Russian satellite states. And if you go south of Iran, you find Saudi Arabia and some other of the Persian Gulf nations. Quite a tricky part of the world. And, of course, all those nations, Iraq, Syria, eastern Turkey, the southern Russian states, Saudi Arabia, Oman, UAE, those are all Muslim countries. But from the Iranian perspective, they're all Sunni Muslims, whereas Iran is Shia Muslim, and they don't have much love for each other. The Shias think the Sunnis are heretics, and of course, you know, vice versa. There is no love lost between Iran and any of those countries I just mentioned. So it looks like sometime soon, Iran's going to launch its blitzkrieg attack into Saudi Arabia, into Iraq, into Syria, into parts of Russia, and so on. Eastern Turkey. When? Don't know. But it could be fairly soon. And then some time passes and we get Daniel 8, verses 5 through 7. Of course, there's a counterattack. And as I was considering, suddenly a male goat or a he-goat came from the west, so it's going to head east, something currently far west of Iran, Suddenly a male goat came from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground, so great speed, possibly signifying airborne attack. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Then he came to the ram that had the two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, ran at him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him. Hatred here. And of course it's religious hatred as well. Attacked the ram, broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him to the ground and trampled him. And no one could deliver the ram from his hand. Now, who is the he-goat? Well, look at verse 21. And the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn between its eyes is the first king. Well, it says Greece there, but the Hebrew, it's Hebrew now, of course, is Javan, J-A-V-A-N, or Yavan, Y-A-V-N, which is really Asia Minor. And most of that today is occupied by Turkey, of course, a Muslim country, who clearly attacks Iran, mega destruction. You might think, well, it's a bit surprising that Turkey would be a war-making nation, but look at its history. You know, the Ottoman Empire was the major Islamic empire that ruled across literally Southeast Europe, the Middle East, North Africa, parts of Arabia for 600 years, over half a millennium. That Ottoman Empire was in fact the Turkish Empire, ruled from Constantinople, or nowadays of course known as Istanbul. And we've often mentioned in the past that Istanbul has a, or Turkey has a very powerful president these days, charismatic, certainly very important in his own eyes, President Erdogan. And he intends to restore the greatness of the Ottoman Empire to Turkey. He is a man to watch. He may well be, if it's going to happen anytime soon, he may well be that notable horn. And Turkey is Sunni Muslims, who consider the Iranian Shia Muslims as heretics. So religious animosity as well as desire for the greatness of Turkey. So the summary of verse of chapter 8 is an end-time war in the Middle East and Persian Gulf involving Iran and Turkey and its allies. And you might think, well, fair enough, that's well over in Turkey somewhere, and Iran, those far-off distant countries, won't concern me too much. Well, think again, because once you destroy the oil industry in the Persian Gulf, you can expect massive economic and financial devastation everywhere in the world. Like all of our economies would just crash and burn. So we might not see the missiles and the jihadists running up and down with, you know, swords and things, beheading, but don't kid yourself, the world will suffer enormously if the Persian Gulf, you know, is set on fire. Now, I covered a lot of this in much, much, much more detail a couple of years back, so if you want to get more of information from what we're just skating over today, there are messages on the website under the heading of, you know, Daniel and Prophecy, and my wife's got notes that she did at the time, so even if you don't want to spend an hour and a quarter listening to me warbling away, you can probably read through the notes in 10 or 15 minutes to pick up some of those details. So if you're interested, off you go. Okay, that brings us to Daniel chapter 9. And in Daniel chapter 9, Daniel has come to realize from the prophecies of Jeremiah that 70 years of prophecy is almost up, and that the punishment of Jerusalem is drawing to an end. So Daniel decides to take action and to pray for the restoration of God's city, Jerusalem, and God's temple in Jerusalem. Let's pick up in Daniel 9, read verses 1 through 6. In the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, of the lineage of the Medes, who was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood by the books the number of the years specified by the word of the Lord given through Jeremiah the prophet, that he would accomplish 70 years in the desolations of Jerusalem. So, Daniel, good Bible student, studying the prophecy of the day, and comes to realize that, hey, you know what? 70 years have been prophesied against Jerusalem. Well, hang on a second. I think that 70 years must be just about up. Verse 3. Then I set my face toward the Lord God to make request by prayer and supplications with fasting, sackcloth and ashes. And I prayed to the Lord my God and made confession and said, O Lord, great and awesome God, who keeps his covenant and mercy with those who love him and with those who keep his commandments, we have sinned and committed iniquity. We have done wickedly and rebelled, even by departing from your precepts and your judgments. Neither have we heeded your servants, the prophets, you know, such as Jeremiah, who spoke in your name to our kings and our princes, to our fathers and all the people of the land. So he rehearses the stupidity, you know, the disobedience, the rebellion of Israel, in particular Judah, the house of Judah, and turns to God. Let's read verses 17 through 19. Now therefore, our God, hear the prayer of your servant and his supplications for the Lord's sake. Cause your face to shine on your sanctuary, which is desolate. Now, Daniel has huge love for God's temple, which he must barely remember, of course, having been taken captive as a teenage boy. But he says, please, great God, cause your face to shine once more on your temple, which is desolate. O my God, incline your ear and hear. Open your eyes, see our desolations and the city which is called by your name. For we do not present our supplications before you because of our righteous deeds, but because of your great mercies. O Lord, hear. O Lord, forgive. O Lord, listen and act. Do not delay for your own sake, my God, for your city and your people are called by your name. So, you know, Daniel's all agitated and passionate. You know, please, let's get the ball rolling. Let's restore Jerusalem and the temple, please, God, because of your great mercies, nothing we can do to merit it. And in response to, you know, Daniel's passionate prayer, God sends an angel with a message to Daniel, the famous 70 weeks prophecy, which allows for plenty of debate. But let's pick up in verses 24 through 27. It's only four verses, but they're quite long verses, as you can see. Verse 24, 70 weeks are determined for, this is the angel brings this message to Daniel, 70 weeks are determined for your people and for your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. So it looks like you got 70 weeks until everything's finished. Now, 70 weeks isn't actually 70 weeks. Why should it be? But the word weeks there in the Hebrew, it's now Hebrew, is Shabua, S-H-A-B-U-A, Shabua, which simply means sevens, or seven. So 70 sevens are determined for your people and for your holy city. 70 sevens, which makes 490. And I think almost everybody believes, as I do, is talking of years. 70 weeks, but prophetically, 70 times 7, 490 years in prophecy until everything is finished. 490 years. Verse 25. Know therefore, understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem, a particular edict or decree that the king will issue, until Messiah the Prince, Jesus, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street of the city shall be built again, and the wall even in troublesome times. So from this particular decree of the king until Jesus, Messiah the Prince, will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks, which comes to, in prophecy, 483 years. Okay. And after the 62 weeks part, Messiah shall be cut off, slain. Jesus' death, we take it to be, but not for himself. Of course, it's for you and me. And the people of the prince who is to come, there is a prince to come, the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city, Jerusalem, and the sanctuary, again. The end of it shall be with a flood. Until the end of the war, desolations are determined. Then he, the prince who is to come, shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week or 7 years, one takes it to be. But in the middle of the seven-year period, middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering, and on the wing of abominations shall be one who makes desolate, desolator, even until the consummation which is determined is poured out on the desolate or desolator. So, a tricky little passage, which has caused lots of debate. And again, we covered this in some depth earlier, so there are notes on the website and so on. But you've got this first reference in verse 25 to 7 weeks and 62 weeks until Messiah the Prince. That is 483 years, and depending on when you start the count from, this brings you to approximately 26 or 27 AD, which is when we believe Jesus was baptized and began his public ministry. So, rather interestingly, although Daniel was writing way back in the 500s BC, he seems to give you a chronology that will bring you to the baptism of the Lord Jesus Christ in 26 or 27 AD. But people argue over when you start the count. So if you want to amuse yourself or be frustrated, get on Google and Google it. But of more relevance to us, I guess, is the end time. And that is the final week, the final 7 years. Because it mentions here in verse 26, a prince who is to come, verse 27, who shall confirm a covenant, or my margin says treaty, with many for 1 7-year period. But in the middle of that 7-year period, he will bring an end to the sacrifices, and you see a reference to an abomination, a desolating abomination. And he breaks his covenant, it seems, at the halfway point, right? In the middle of the week, in the middle of the seven. What's halfway through seven? 3.5. So through this 7-year treaty, halfway through it, the sacrifices are stopped and an abomination that desolates is set up, triggering then 3.5 years of tribulation. Now, my background, probably your background, is that along with, say, the Seventh-day Adventists, the Worldwide Church of God, some other churches, we took the final prince here to be still talking about Jesus, the prince who is to come. And he died midweek. We took that to be literally the middle of the week, so that's Wednesday crucifixion. And then we said, well, you know, Jesus had a 3.5-year ministry, which was cut short on a Wednesday. And that probably means he's got another 3.5 year to confirm his ministry, confirm his new covenant for 3.5 years somewhere or other. And then people would debate, well, I think that's probably the 3.5 years in the place of safety. I think somehow Jesus will take his saints there and confirm his covenant, sort of, with them. Others said, no, I think it's the first 3.5 years of the millennium that Jesus confirms his covenant when he first sets up his kingdom. Others said, no, I think this all took place historically. I think the first 3.5 years after Jesus went back to heaven, the apostles confirmed the covenant to the Jews for 3.5 years before they gave up and went to the Gentiles. And on it goes. Right? Problems here. First of all, it says, the prince who is to come, he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 7-year period. I think grammatically, that he who confirms the covenant has to be the prince who is to come, whose people have actually destroyed the temple and Jerusalem. So it's the Antichrist we're talking about. I think grammatically, that's the only antecedent to he that makes any sense. Also, while we're on this point, who said Jesus' ministry was 3.5 years in duration? If you're going to say that the prince is Jesus, who confirms the covenant for 7 years, and halfway through it he was crucified, who says Jesus' ministry was 3.5 years duration? It's a popular view. It's probably fairly accurate, but I know there are some Bible scholars who will tell you Jesus' complete ministry was only 70 weeks in duration. Other Bible scholars will tell you it was nearer to 2 years. Quite a few do indeed say 3.5 years, or maybe 3 years. And even I've seen one wild idea that says 15 years. Wow. I suspect that one's rather out. But, you know, it's an assumption that Jesus' ministry was 3.5 years. You can't absolutely prove it. And so a bit dangerous to interpret Daniel 9:27 here as somehow referring to Jesus' 3.5 year ministry that he did first time round and 3.5 more years somewhere else. In any event, it says it's 1:7. It's a 7 year period we're talking about. And that, I believe, is at the very end of the age. This Antichrist Islamic powerful individual enters into a 7 year treaty. You could call it a covenant of death, which is what Isaiah 28 calls it. And halfway through that 7 year treaty, at the 3.5 year point, he then reneges on the treaty. He stops the sacrifices in the temple. He erects the abomination of desolation, which Jesus warned us to look out for, right? Jesus said, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, then flee. If you're in Judea, flee. Don't stop. Urgent. Get out of there. And then Matthew adds in brackets, he who reads about this abomination of desolation spoken by Daniel, let him understand. Because that's what we're trying to do here. To understand. And again, there's messages on the website in more detail, so I'm, you know, obviously hurrying through this time round. Well, not hurrying particularly quickly, but, you know, hurrying more than I would otherwise. So the summary of chapter 9 of Daniel is the 70 weeks prophecy and the final 7 year treaty, including the abomination of desolation. Daniel 9 is the 70 weeks prophecy and the final 7 year treaty, including the abomination of desolation. So that's us getting towards the end now. There's only one more sort of part to do, which clearly we're not going to do today. But chapter 10 is the beginning of a long section, which is chapter 10 and chapter 11 and chapter 12. It's only 12 chapters. It starts in chapter 10 and it runs unbroken to the end of the book. You know, sometimes we read chapter 10 and stop, then chapter 11 and stop, then chapter 12 and stop, treat them as independent, standalone chapters or not. Chapter 10 begins and runs all the way through the chapter and all the way through 11 and all the way to the end of 12. It is one long passage dealing with prophecy from Daniel's day right up to the resurrection of the saints, which is mentioned in Daniel 12. And chapter 10, which we're not going to get to, of course, tells us about God sending an angel with this very special key message. But that, we'll have to wait now. So that's going to be 2 weeks, I guess, from today, God willing, because remember, we're not here next week. But with that, we'll conclude the Bible study, at least as for today.